This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Just like Leicester City this season. So the only thing left to say is, you win, order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too. So that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants, 18 plus. Rewards registration required, points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And now for something completely different.
Watch us on YouTube. Listen on your favourite podcast platform. Or ask your smart speaker to play the podcast Leicester Till I Die.
Subscribe, like, follow and join in now.
Strap yourself in.
Because we're set up, switched on and ready to go.
On Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport, powered by fans.
Right, Chris.
All right, good evening. How the devil are you? Hope you can hear me okay. New microphone this week. And let's just say, there's a few gremlins. So hopefully you can hear me okay. Welcome along, Leicester Till I Die. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you very much. On Twitter, we're on all the social networks. Just search Leicester Till I Die TV. And if you are listening on your favourite podcast platform, be that Spotify, Google, or Apple iTunes, or many, many others, thank you very much for lending me your ears. You can have them back later, but I won't be cleaning them for you. This is The Conversation, and I'm pleased to say we have got another ex-player. He played for us over 100 times, believe it or not, during sort of the late 80s. Had a career, a small career with England. Best known, I suppose, for his time at Ipswich. And after us, he went on to Southampton. But we're going to be talking to him about, obviously, Leicester, but his whole career as well. And I'm really pleased that and thank him for joining us. And that's Mr. Russell Osmond. Good evening, Russell. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Chris. How are you doing?
Not so bad, thank you. Are you okay?
Yep, very good. Thank you.
Can you hear me okay? That's the question.
Afraid so, as some might say.
Oh, thank you. Remember, I've got the control over the mute button.
No problem.
As long as you can hear, because this microphone is playing up a little bit. I'm still trying to get used to it. But Yeah, like you said, you played for Leicester in sort of the late 80s, but you started out, you're a Derby lad, and your dad was a footballer.
Yeah, my dad played at Derby County for a few years. I think it was back in the very late 40s, 50s, that sort of time. He used to speak about people like Jackie Stamp, the centre forward, and Jackie used to come in my dad's pub and stuff like that. So, Reg Carter, one or two of the other very well known ex Derby County players, you know. And I grew up going to the baseball ground, watching games there. If you want me to, I can name you the Derby County side from the early 70s when Les Green was in goal and got John O'Hare, Kevin Hector, Alan Hinton. All those sort of guys. Alan Hinton, you know, wearing white boots, which is quite novel at the time then. And, you know, you used to go and watch games there. And once you got past sort of October, there wasn't much grass on the pitches in those days. Now I think the players are a little bit spoiled because they play on perfect pitches, you know, every month of the season.
Totally. I mean, I don't know if I like to watch the ITV4 Big Match Revisited with Elton Wellesby, who's a good friend of the channel. It comes on quite a bit. And when you look at some of those pitches and you're thinking, how did players manage to play as well as they did? Because you got the odd flair player, you know, Georgie Best. We had Keith Weller. But some of the pitches, like you say, that you could have been doing mud wrestling.
Yeah, well, I watched one of those games probably just over a week ago. Very muddy, no grass on the pitch, and it was wet as well. So you could see all the puddles and everything. Suddenly there was a crossfield pass hit in the attacking half that was inch perfect from about 40 yards. The first touch was great. It was then stood back up onto the far post. Somebody came in with a glorious header on the far post and stuck it in the bottom corner. And you thought, in those days, you didn't need a perfect pitch to be able to string three or four perfect passes together.
I mean, this is why I always find it difficult. Some people sort of are trying to compare players from different generations. And obviously, you know, you've got the likes of Pelé, which a lot of youngsters obviously never saw him play. And RIP, obviously, to Pelé. But when he was so good on pitches like that, it'd just be amazing now.
Yeah, well, obviously, I had the pleasure of playing with Pelé during the Escape to Victory filming.
I was going to come on to that one,
back in the 80s. But, you know, you're talking about Pelé, you're talking about people like George Best, Dennis Law, Bobby Charlton, people of that calibre and that era. They were fantastic players. People like Tony Curry, Alan Ball. Great passes of the ball, Stan Bowles, somebody ran with the ball exceptionally well. Yeah. You know, and those names just roll off the tongue from that era. Mm-hmm. What was funny, I was talking to Terry Butcher this afternoon.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, somebody came along and sort of joined us for the conversation and then said, well, do you think that we could cope with playing in the game in this modern era? And Terry sort of spun it on his head straight away and said, hold on a minute. Do you think the players of today could cope and play in our era where you were expected to play 90 minutes every game? You're expected to play every Saturday, every Tuesday, every Saturday. You know, they hoped you were stayed fit to play 40-odd games a season, you know, year in, year out. You know, so when you turn it around that way, it's an argument, isn't it?
Oh, it is, totally. And, I mean, when you look at some of the tackles that were going in, I mean, not so long ago, I mean, they always call it the dirtiest game ever, the Leeds-Chelsea, I think it was a cup replay, and that was the one that was on the telly. My God, they look like goalkeeper versus goalkeeper these days. You can't tackle or touch, it's no longer in contact.
Well, Jack Charlton flying through the back of players there. And there was one... when was it? Francis Lee had a punch up with somebody when he was playing for Derby County as well. Norman Hunter, Francis Lee, Norman Hunter, and that went on for ages. That did.
Yes. You did make me laugh when you said about Alan Hinton wearing white boots, because we've got a player at the moment, Kieran Dewsbury-Hall. And yeah, I don't think he's got a sponsorship deal with boots yet, because he just wears black boots, and it's so odd to see a player wearing black boots, you know. But
nice to see.
It is, yes. I mean, like I say, I grew up with players wearing black boots. But what was it like having a dad who was an ex-footballer? I mean, I've not coached any sort of level. I was sort of a McDonald's FA stage one. Coach for my kids' team, which is basically enthusiastic dad stage. That's all it is, you know.
Yeah.
And as a parent, it's so hard to sort of stand on the back and bite your tongue, even if you've never played the game or had anything to do. What was it like? Because obviously your dad would come and watch you.
My dad would come and watch, yeah. But my dad was a publican, you know, spent a lot of time doing a lot of hours in the pub.
Yeah.
In Repton, the Bull's Head in Repton. But my dad came along to watch the game and support the game.
Mm.
And that's all he was there for. Very rarely did he pass any comment on how we actually played the game. And having had three kids myself all go into the academy system, it's difficult. It's very difficult, you know, and I have nephews that play the game now, and you stand on the touchline with other parents, and they look at you sometimes as if I should know what's going on. Sometimes I haven't got a clue why certain players get picked, why certain players get left out, why your own players don't progress further in the game. It's difficult. It's difficult being a parent, and it's difficult being the son of an ex-player. Yeah, it can be a bit of a minefield.
I know we had Steve Lanix on last week, and he never says sort of who he is when he goes to watch his son. But he said, yeah. I've been going week after week after week. And basically, he said, I could see nothing was happening. And he went up to speak to the coach and said, look, have any of these players ever progressed? And he said, well, no, if I'm honest with you. And he says, well, you know, why do you think that is? And he says, well, who are you? What do you know about football?
Yeah.
Well, it's the only time he's ever said to anybody, just said, go Google me, you know?
Yeah. But, Chris, I had a situation years ago when one of my kids was in an academy setup and leading goal scorer by Christmas, but hadn't started a game. So he went to see the academy manager, you know, thought he was doing well enough to want to start in the side, and the academy manager sort of spun on him and said, sorry son, but you've got to learn to fight for a position in this team, something your father never had to do in his life.
Oh.
So my lad just said to me, he said, well, yeah, but what's that got to do with me?
Yes,
you know, and what position that is to put a kid in.
Well,
you know, and it ended up that was a grudge that somebody held against me, because I kept them out the Ipswich Town youth team sort of 25 years earlier.
Oh, my God.
You know, that's what you have to deal with sometimes.
They say revenge is the dish served best served cold, but that was bloody freezing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. That was a test of my temper, that was.
I can imagine. I suppose the one thing, though, is when you went to your dad and said, like, Dad, I want to be a footballer, he couldn't say no, could he, having been one himself?
No, he couldn't really. But, I mean, my dad grew up, I mean, he fought in Korea and, you know, was in the army for a while. And my granddad on his side was a regimental sergeant major. So, you know, I think my dad never talked about career or anything like that. Never spoke about his time in the services whatsoever. But loved his time. He was a man's man. You know, he liked a pint, liked a cigarette, liked a game of golf, and liked his sport.
Yeah. Like we say, Derbyshire lad, presumably schooling in Derbyshire, and yet your
Staffordshire, actually. I went to Burton Grammar School.
Oh, right. Well, rugby. In Staffordshire, I mean, your first club, even as a youth career, was Ipswich Town.
Yeah. I played for Repton Casuals as a kid growing up on a Sunday. I say, I went to grammar school, so I played rugby on a Saturday. I played football on the Sunday for the village team. And I played for the senior side in the Derby and District local cup final 1 year. And somebody got word back to Bobby Robson's brother that Tom, I think his name was, who lived in the area, and said, there's this young lad playing for the senior side in the Derby District final, worth a look. And we won the game. And then I got an invite down to have a trial with Ipswich Town. And in those days, what Sir Bobby Robson realised was that they didn't have the money to go and buy players at Ipswich. I think he only bought something like 11 or 15 players in all the time that he was there. So Bobby realised he needed to invest in the youth system. So to get good players, you needed to have a good scouting system. And Ron Gray was his main scout up in the northeast and northwest. And they used to bring down coach loads of kids every school holiday, you know, and I joined them for some games or trial games. Lucky that they went well for me. And then I got invited to play for the youth team on a couple of occasions. And that was while I was still at school.
Wow. And I mean, we briefly spoke about Bobby Robson before we came in. Like I said, then one of the few managers, I think, who is liked by more than sort of just the clubs that he's managed. Yeah. I mean, I don't think of Leicester ever as being a big club, even after sort of recent years. And it was like Ipswich then to go, and what Bobby Robson did with Ipswich was almost, if not better, than what you know has happened with Leicester.
Well, I think what happened with Sir Bobby, we sort of had an identity on the pitch of how we played the game of football. And I think through the early 70s to the early 80s, then we became the favourite second team for a lot of people. So as I travelled all over Europe, all over the world, people would say, oh, yes, I remember your side. Even though I'm a Liverpool supporter, I can name you your side from 1978 or 1976 or 1981. Which is a lot easier than trying to do it these days, by the way. But we ended up being sort of a lot of people's favourite second team because of the style of football that we played and the leadership under Sir Bobby.
I mean, there were great years. He was obviously the manager when you were there. I mean, I'm just looking there, 79. He was like 14 years or something, 14 seasons as manager. I mean, once you get past Fergie and Arsene Wenger, no manager does that these days.
No, not at all. You know, he weathered a storm there early on because I think he had a bit of a rough start. And I think the chairman, Mr. John Cobbold, called him into the office one day. And I think Sir Bobby thought his days were numbered then and came out with a new five-year contract. That's what
again, something else you wouldn't see these days, unfortunately. Nearly 300 games for you at Ipswich, 17 goals, which is not bad for a centre back. I mean, what was Bobby Robson like to manage? Because I say on the outside, and again, we touched on this, but on the outside, he always seemed such a gentle giant, you know. He, like I say, when we lost that semi-final to Germany, you know, the click of his fingers, the shrug of his arm. But was he sort of, I mean, he'd learnt his trade, hadn't he, as well?
Yeah, he learned his trade and he was very tight with the FA. But what he was, from the football point of view, he kept the game very simple. And he tried to mould a team where all the players fitted closely together and fitted well together. So he talked about it being like a jigsaw where each piece fitted neatly with the next piece alongside. So the two center halves formed a close relationship and knitted well. Your midfield players all knitted well. Your defense worked well with your midfield, and your wide players or your front players all bonded well together. So you got this tight well-knitted team of players there. And it was a case of, one, we were extremely fit. We worked very hard on fitness. We worked exceptionally hard on the basics of the game, being able to pass the ball and control the ball exceptionally well. And being very fit, I think that gave us an edge on a lot of teams that, even if we weren't playing particularly well, we had good basics to fall back on.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was going to outwork us. Nobody was going to outpass us. Technically, we might have not had the most skillful players in the world, but we were very good at what we could do. And so Bobby kept the game very simple. You know, give it to somebody in the same colour shirt as you, and let's get on from there. But and we didn't have any interference from above. And I've got to tell you a quick story about our chairman, John Cobbold. He came to watch us play at Leicester one day, and Leicester City beat Ipswich 3-0. And the chairman, John Cobbold, old Etonian, they used to own a brewery, so they used to like a glass of champagne or two.
Yeah.
John Cobbold came in after the game into the boardroom at Leicester, saw Sir Bobby there, went up to Bobby and said, Bobby, he said, I thought our lads were absolutely fantastic today, especially in the second half. They were absolutely superb, great performance. And Sir Bobby said, Mr. John, we played in yellow today, not blue and white.
Oh, brilliant.
Mr. John just stood there. He said, well, you wouldn't expect a chairman like me to know that, would you?
Fair point. Oh, I love that. Absolutely love it. You never quite won the league, though. I think you came second one season, didn't you?
Yeah, 1981. Aston Villa won the title that year. We beat them three times that season. We won the UEFA Cup and we got knocked out of the FA Cup at the semi-final stage at Villa Park, of all places, by Manchester City, a Paul Power extra time free kick. It still bugs us a little bit, but we played 66 competitive games that year, and I played every minute of every game. Aston Villa played, I think it was something like 48 games that year, and only used 14 players. I think they had eight players played every game that year for them. And we just ran out of steam by the end of the season. You know, we lost one or two league games on the bounce in the running, and that's how Aston Villa pipped us, you know, and fair play to them for what they did.
But you went on to win the UEFA Cup. I mean, what a great run you had in that season.
Yeah, we played some difficult fixtures, you know, but we were very good at home. And then we managed to keep things pretty tight away from home when we needed to. We won away from home in Cologne. We beat St. Etienne 4-1 away from home on an absolutely diabolical pitch. And then the two-legged final against St. Etienne, we got a very good lead in the first leg of the game. And then it's a little bit tighter than we would have hoped for the second leg. But, you know, we managed to scrape through.
I'm just looking here. I mean, in the third round over, because everything was obviously two-legged, the good old days before you had all these groups and everything like that. Yeah. But, I mean, just find you in the, you just got past Prague sort of 3-2 on aggregate. So, yeah, that one was a bit tight, to be honest with you. Then in the third round, you beat... I'm useless with anything outside of England. You beat them 5-1.
Yeah. And the second leg there, out in Poland, we were I think there's about 6 inches of snow on the pitch before the game.
Right.
And the problem was that the fixture list was that tight. And UEFA was saying, well, listen, you know, if we call the game off now, we've got to reschedule it. You don't really want it rescheduled. We have the option where we can sort of scrape the excess snow off the pitch. And if you watch it on YouTube or any platform like that, you'll see that the pitch is actually white. with red markings on it, red lines. Yeah. So they did all the lines in red. There's a bank of snow about 2 yards off each side of the pitch and behind the goals. Mm. And we basically just played on top of the snow just to get the game out of the way. But like you say, we had a good lead from the first leg.
I was going to say, really, unless you had a huge collapse, 5-0 from the first leg, you were through, really, weren't you?
Yeah, but it was freezing. It was something like about minus 10 when we played. I remember we had a big litre bottle of Johnny Walker's scotch in the changing room. So Bobby insisted everybody had a swig out of the bottle before we went onto the pitch. You know, we'd been out for warm-up, came back in. He said, listen, everybody have a mouthful of this before you go out, because that cold air is really going to hit you just before the game. So I think Kevin Beattie got hold of the bottle later and there wasn't a lot left.
I was going to say, how many of you went out there drunk? And again, though, it didn't matter at 5-0 up. And then, as you mentioned, I mean, quarterfinal, St Etienne, first leg away, 4-1 up. And again, you must be thinking at that point, our name's on the cup.
Well, we were playing well at the time, but we were starting to pick up one or two little injuries along the way. We'd lost George Burley, who got injured around about January, February time, I think. So we lost George Burley with a cruciate knee injury, so he was out for the season there. And we were playing some good football, and we had a closeness of the group. I mean, even before the St Etienne game, we were given a bit of free time on the Tuesday lunchtime to wander around the town centre and see a few of the sights. And I think most of the lads sat in the bar and had a few pints and a couple of games of darts.
A team developing here, isn't there, with Ipswich at that time?
Well, in those days, that's how the game was.
Yeah,
you know, we saw the players' lounge, and one of the best examples I saw in a players' lounge was your own Steve Walsh when I played alongside Walshy, who I think is a brilliant fella.
Yeah, lovely guy.
He played against Billy Whitehurst one day at Filbert Street, the old Filbert Street, and they smashed 7 bells out of each other. They got splits over the eye. I think somebody got a tooth knocked out, bent nose, cut on the face. And as soon as the final whistle went, they were hugging each other, walking off down the tunnel with their arms around each other, thinking, great, we'll see you again in a few weeks, Bill. Oh, get showered quickly and I'll see you in the bar. We'll have a few pints before you get on the coast to go home. And when I got in there, they were on about the 4th pint, just laughing and joking. They'd been, you know, stitched up and matched up and everything.
But that's how it should be, isn't it?
That's how the game was in those days. There was that drinking culture, and I don't think it would be down too well today.
I can remember Steve Linex again telling us, you know, when Mark Wallington, the goalkeeper, used to listen to the team talk before the match, sat on the bog, door open, having a fag. that was what it was like in the day. And yes, you could knock 7 bells out of each other on the pitch. But then, like you say, it didn't carry on. Occasionally it was off the field, but 9 times out of 10 it was, like you say, come and have a drink and what have you. And Steve Walsh is such a quiet guy when you speak to him.
Yeah.
He pulls that shirt on and wow.
We had Walshy, Ali Mocklin, who's great. You know, and Ali came down with Guy McAllister in sort of 81 as well, when 85 when I first came along. Tony Seeley. You know, we're talking about lads with a lot of character. John O'Neill, centre-half, brilliant. Brighty up front, sort of Lineker's replacement, if you like. Great squad of players that would stick together both on and off the pitch.
Yeah. You got to the final. AZ out, Mark. I mean, it was a tight one. Again, you won the first leg 3-0. You lost the second leg 4-2, but 5-4 on aggregate, that's all that matters. That must have been a one amazing feeling, because that was then, of course, no Champions League. So before Champions League, it was the, you know, main competition in Europe, and you were champions of Europe.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think we were chosen as Adidas European Team of the Year that year as well. But in the second leg, and it was strange, you know, we led from the first leg 3-0, as you quite rightly said, Chris.
Yeah.
And we thought, well, if we can keep things tight for the first 10, 15 minutes of the game, great, fantastic. We actually scored about 10 minutes into the game to make it 4-0.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, AZ Alkmaar, they got nothing to lose now. They absolutely chucked the kitchen sink at us. Johnny Methard, who ended up playing up at Forest up the road, as well.
Yes, yeah.
Spell boss, Keys, they got some decent players in the side and they just threw everything at us. And they had what I've got, you know, one or two lucky breaks that led to a couple of goals. And all of a sudden, it was a bit of a hang on job towards the end. But, you know, we got another goal. So it all got sorted out.
I mean, looking at that side, I mean, it was Paul Cooper in goal, who as well late in his career ended up at Leicester. Mick Mills, England captain, future England captain. Oh, Frank Thijssen, one of the first. Sorry, I can never say, I'm useless with names. One of the first, and a great player, majestic on the ball, but one of the first, what we call foreign players that was in the game, I believe. Russell Osman, well, that's yourself, isn't it? Russell Osman, Terry Butcher, John Walk, another one, Arnold Muren, and he was another great player, wasn't he? Paul Mariner, Alan, I mean, Brazil. When you look back, I think it's a team that you look back on and think, wow, probably more so than you did at the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of us think that the side really should have maybe won a little bit more than we actually did. But, you know, we got a few injuries. Like I said, George Burley got a serious knee injury that season. At the end of the 81 season, the following year, we weren't great. And then so Bobby left to join the FA and take over as England manager. And the club had sort of overstretched itself a little bit, you know, to build a new stand. So money was a little bit tight. I think there's a European ban that came into force as well. So we weren't getting the revenue in that we needed. And suddenly one or two of the players had to be sold and players got, you know, there was no improvement in contracts, you know, and it was the same. Suddenly it was my turn to move on, and that was 85, and that's basically why I came up to Leicester.
I'm going to say it must have been a wrench to leave Ipswich after all that time. Was it? Did you have choices, or was it just Leicester that had come in for you?
How it happened, it was a bit of a disappointing way to leave the club, really, because I was asked to go and have a chat about my contract with Bobby Ferguson, who was the old reserve team coach, first team coach who took over from Bobby Robson. And he just said, listen, you know, we've got no money. Try and find yourself a club and we'll sort a deal out. And that's it, really. And from that point on to the end of the season, which was about another 3 months, you know, he made it a little bit uncomfortable for me. And it was a case of trying to sort something out as soon as I could. Gordon Milne and Leicester City made contact, and I thought, well, you know, that's a nice club, similar sort of size and same sort of characteristics as Ipswich Town. And, you know, when I first went up to Leicester, you know, I enjoyed it. Met Gordon Milne, had a nice chat with him. I know from playing against Leicester City what a great crowd that they got up there. So really, I didn't think too much about it. You know, it was a nice deal, and I know I had to go somewhere, so I just wanted to get things done as quickly as I could.
And it was strange because it wasn't the best of times, unfortunately, at Leicester for those seasons. And Gordon Milne, like you say, was manager. Who, you know, he moved up, obviously, after a while. But I don't think he ever had sort of a fair crack of the whip. But he came in, and we that season, that first season, sort of 85-86, we finished 19th and just stayed up because it was two down at the time. Unfortunately, at the expense of Ipswich Town.
Yeah, well, funny old story, that, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, yeah, by one point as well, you know, it couldn't have been any closer. And then the following season, we did go down, unfortunately. David, were you there when David Pleat came in?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, not one of the most popular managers there's ever been at Leicester. What was he like to play under?
I quite enjoyed my time with David. In between David Pleat and Gordon Milne was Brian Hamilton, who's ex-Ipswich player that I'd known anyway, and I still see Brian now. And Brian was responsible for Stevie Walsh coming down from Wigan. Mm. With David Pleat, he had a good understanding with players. If he could understand the players, you could get on with him. And he gave players the authority to do what needed to be done on the pitch. You know, I remember speaking to some managers saying, listen, we need to either, you know, compress things and keep closer to the halfway line and push up a little bit. And they said, no, you know, and they would go against what I thought needed to be done. Whereas Pleaty would say, listen, if you want to hold a high back line and you think you can cope with it, you're the lads on the pitch, you know what's going on. Or if you feel you can drop off to counteract them trying to get in behind you, you do that. But you take responsibility for it and make sure it works.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So from that point of view, he was very understanding, you know, and he is an encyclopedia of football, David Pleat, and players, yes. And always very interesting to talk to.
He's always, I mean, when he does a co-commentary, he always knew his stuff. You know, he was never going to get caught out. During that time, of course, you played with Steve Lynx. Now, Steve Lynx is a regular on the show. He's just texted me now because he does the prediction show with us, and he's not doing very well. But
he's left back, wasn't he?
Winger, right winger. Yeah. Although he was in goal for home game, if you remember.
Yeah. He used to come along every morning in a car. And they used to car share Steve Lynx, right. Alan Smith, Bob Hazel.
Wow.
Yeah, they used to come over from, yeah. Say no more.
No, there's a threesome. But were you part of the game? Because obviously he's gone down in folklore for two games. One, which I don't think you were in, which was the cup game against Shrewsbury. But the game, I think it was against Southampton when it was called off because it was raining and he was swimming across the pitch. I don't know if you were there for that one. Because I know you went obviously on to play for Southampton.
Yeah, I played a few times at Southampton where it probably shouldn't have been allowed a carrier. When did Matt Letizia make his debut? Because I think he scored a hat-trick on his debut against us one year. Now, I was either playing for Leicester or for Ipswich. He might have even been playing for Leicester, I think.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Away days are great, but when you can't play away, there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus. Serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Let's have a look. what would we do without Wikipedia, eh? he made his club debut. Oh, no. Matt Letizia made his club debut in a 4-3 defeat at Norwich. By the end of the season, he scored 6 goals in 24 league games, including a hat trick against Leicester City in the league. He signed professional forms in 86. So that, I'm guessing, would be 86-87 season.
Well, the pitch that day was absolutely diabolical. Freezing cold, puddles on the pitch, all sorts of stuff. And Matt Letizia was scooting past people. One of the finest players I've ever played with. Yeah. You know, balance, technique. And if you look at his video of his best 100 goals, like there's long range efforts, there's headers, there's side foots, there's chips, there's benders, there's left foot, there's right foot. Wonderful player. Great player.
I mean, again, I don't think he played for England enough, did he?
No, what if he played once, didn't he?
Yeah, it was very much a culture in those days, and some would say it still is, where you only get into the England team if you play for certain teams.
Yeah, but Glenn Hoddle got left out of the England side on numerous occasions because people didn't feel that he worked hard enough off the ball. Then when Glenn Hoddle becomes manager, he doesn't pick Matt Letizia for the same reason, which I thought was just hypocritical.
Yeah, you can't work it out. But you scored. Let me just have a look. You scored 8 goals in 108 games for Leicester. You contributed on that. Was it good times? Would you say you have happy memories of Leicester?
I had a great time at Leicester. I had 3 fantastic years. I ended up living out in Hallerton. Used to see a bit of Robbie James when the late Robbie James was there. He was living at Kibworth, so we used to come in there together. I know Ali Mocklin's still out that way now. Still speak to Guy McAllister. Ian Andrews, I thought, was a wonderful goalkeeper in those days. And we had a great side, great team. Mm. Like I mentioned, John O'Neill early on, Bobby Smith, Ian Wilson, Andy Feely. Yeah, grateful.
Do you remember Paul Reid?
Yes, I do.
Down in Wales now, I believe.
Nice, quiet, calm lad, wasn't he?
He was. he is now off the pitch, you know. Yeah. But, Ian Andrew, they always had good goalkeepers at Leicester. That was, that was one, thing about Leicester. And obviously, Alan Smith was there, and then he was sold to Arsenal, and he came back. But you went to join Southampton, on the South Coast again. Why was the move there?
Well, I'd done 3 years at Leicester, which was the length of my initial contract, and I spoke to David Pleat, and I basically said, "Listen, if you make me a reasonable offer, I'm more than happy to stay longer." And he came back with an offer, which I didn't think was beneficial enough. So I said, "Well, I would hope that you'd be able to improve that offer." Mm-hmm. He said, "No, that's the only offer that's going to be on the table." I said, "Well, I'm out of contract. I know Southampton are interested. I'll go there." And Southampton were in the first division of the Premier League, as it's called now. And David said, "Well, let me speak to the chairman." I said, "Well, I'm going down this afternoon." So I got in my car and I spoke to David halfway down, and he said he couldn't get hold of the chairman. I said, "Right, well, I'm going to carry on down into Hampshire." They offered me a good deal, and it wasn't about the money. It was more about playing back in the first division again. So off I popped down there and had 3 and a bit, 2 or 3 years playing for the club in Hampshire.
I mean, you couldn't risk not signing, because you hadn't got a team, like you say, at the time, and you've obviously got, you know, family, and you've got your career to think of, and you couldn't really wait around for Leicester, could you?
No, I couldn't. You know, and I was very honest with David Pleat, and I said, if you can speak to the chairman and see if there's a little bit more money available, then I'm more than prepared to consider it. Because my oldest son had been born in Leicester. We'd had a fantastic 3 years hanging about with people like Alan Birchnell and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. Frank Worthington, did you know Frank Worthington?
Yeah, I knew Frank.
He was a character as well.
You know, so I had a great time at Leicester. Yeah. You know, really, really did enjoy it. You know, and we had some good times there. Not as good as they've had since, but, you know, I enjoyed my 3 years there. But when you look at, I was 25, 28 by that time, I think.
Yeah.
28, 29. So I'd still felt I'd got 3 or 4 good years left in me that I could possibly cope with first division rather than second division football. And I took the chance with Southampton and they had 3 more years in the first division.
And it would be amiss of me, and a gentleman called Anthony would never speak to me again if I didn't mention Bristol City, because he's a Bristol City, he's born and bred. He likes his cider. He goes down to the Wurzel Stadium or whatever it's called now for Bristol City, ex-Leicester manager there. And he's come straight in, and he's also an Arsenal fan. But, you know, the typical Arsenal fans, they can't just have one team, can they? But he says, big up, Chris. Russell, what was life like at Bristol City, and who was your favourite signing?
Right. Life in Bristol was very, very good. I had 30 years living in Bristol because I moved over there in 91, after I left Southampton. Southampton, and I had a change of manager, and we had some fella called Bramfoot come in there. And Leicester City, they were just getting over the fact that they had these, you know, lads on 10-year contracts and stuff like that, that really sort of bankrupt the club, and they'd, you know, reinvented themselves again. With some of the lads tearing the contracts up, and watching how Bristol City has grown over that period of time, was good. Around about this time of year in 94, I went from being a player to player manager to more or less manager. We knocked Liverpool out of the FA Cup at Anfield, which was a fantastic night. Graeme Souness was in charge of Liverpool then, and they got in Ian Rush playing, Steve McManaman, John Barnes, Neil Ruddock. So that was a massive game. And when you talk about who was my favourite signings, I think a lot of people would expect me to say Brian Tinian, because he scored that goal at Anfield that night, which was a lovely left foot bender. He was a good lad that we got down from Bradford, Geordie boy. I didn't really get a chance to spend much money at Bristol City, and then they ended up getting the sack, and then you're on the old merry-go-round again. But, you know, I love...
It goes with the position, doesn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, that's it. It's one thing that you know for sure if you take on a job as a football manager, you're going to get a sack.
It's not a case of, you know, how long is it, you know, you're signing the contract for. It's just, how long am I just going to be here for? It would be remiss of me, because Anthony's in, not to mention, of course, you did also have a little bit of a caretaker role at the bigger team in Bristol, of course, Bristol Rovers.
Up the gas.
Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, that was a funny situation, because I'd been out of the game for a little while. I was still doing work, media work for Eurosport and such like. Mm. And the manager had left the club The caretaker manager suddenly thought we're a little bit close to the bottom of the table. I think there's about six games left, and he didn't want to be responsible for being held responsible for taking the team down, because it was bottom of the fourth division then, and they would have been gone out of league football. And I phoned the chairman up and I just said, listen, I'm not doing anything at the moment. If you need a manager, let me do it. Don't pay me. If I keep you up, then give me a bonus and that's the way we'll do it. Yeah. And he said, are you sure? I said, well, why not? You know, I don't think you've got anything to lose. I said, I guarantee you I'll keep you up. And I remember going in for the first game, walking behind the Blackthorn stand, the Blackthorn cider stand.
Yeah.
And one of the big rough supporters coming rushing out of the bar, sort of ranting and raging at me, saying, we don't need you. Well, the gas heads, if you're Bristol City players, it's like, you know, we don't need you people here taking on this club. We don't need you taking on the job. And I was walking in with a referee. I looked behind me. The referee had disappeared. The linesman had disappeared. They'd all sort of scattered. So I'm having this confrontation with this supporter. And I said, hold on a minute. Listen, I'm just here to try and keep you in league football. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Just let me get on with my job and I promise you we will still be in the league at the end of the season. And the fellow said, well, it seemed to calm down a little bit. He said, okay, if you do that, I'll buy you a pint at the end of the season. So I said, okay, fine. And went on my way. After the last game of the season in the hospitality lounge, a bloke in a suit, shirt and tie came up to me. He said, you might not recognize me, but I was the bloke that jumped all over you the first game that you turned up as our caretaker manager.
Mm.
There's the pint I owe you. As good as his word, fantastic. Well,
we can't say fairer than that, can you?
No, so I've got a soft spot for the gas as well.
Yes, yeah. Do you miss managing?
I miss the day-to-day involvement with players, whether you're playing with players, whether you're coaching players, or whether you're managing. It's I think it's something that's always in your blood. I think I would probably struggle a bit these days because it's such a scientific game. I worked in Ipswich Academy back in 2011 to 2013, looking after the under-18s then. And it was just as the ECPP was being introduced and you had to have so many sports scientists and strength and conditioning coach and extra physios and everybody was wanting a piece of the action with the players all the time. And the one thing I was always fighting against was having time with the players actually playing football. You know, the sports science people are saying, well, you've done so many hours on the pitch today and you had a long day yesterday. And you say, hold on, it wasn't a long day. You know, they're saying, well, you know, on our monitors, it's saying the players have worked this hard and that hard. And, you know, and you suddenly... And the game's changed a bit now, and that's why there's so many substitution and players coming on and off and five subs. And
It's a completely, utterly different game, like what we said earlier.
Yeah.
But you also 11 times for England. And that was under Ron Greenwood.
Ron Greenwood and Sir Bobby.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to be my next question. Did Sir Bobby pick you when he became manager after Ron Greenwood?
Well, Sir Bobby was in charge the England side for my first game, which was out in Australia, and it was like a centenary game. And it was like a B international. So Ron Greenwood wasn't in charge of the team. Sir Bobby was as the B team manager, but it was classified as a full cap. And then I missed out on, was it the 82 World Cup? Ron Greenwood left me out of the squad, and then I got left out of the squad in 86 as well. or 84, you know, and it was a bit of a funny time with the England team. You know, we were, you could say, a bit of a transitional period, you know, the end of Kevin Keegan's role, really. Trevor Brooking, people like that were coming to the end of the career. You know, we just weren't playing very well. Norway beat us 1 year, you know, Maggie Thatcher, we beat your boys, all that palaver.
Oh, yeah, don't remind me.
It wasn't a very good time to be in the England squad or trying to establish yourself in the England squad. And my last game was against Denmark at Wembley, and I thought I played pretty well. So Bobby told me he thought I played my best ever game for England, and after that I never got picked again.
Now that sounds like a sort of thing that Brendan Rodgers does. He's a player, then you never see him again.
It does happen.
And then, of course, you almost had a second career in acting. I mean, you know, I remember the Escape to Victory, and I remember the original, not the new one that's absolutely rubbish. How the hell did that come around? It must have been a great time for you.
Well, see, that was back in 1980, 81. So we were quite a good team then. I think we'd been runners up in the league a couple of times or whatever. And so Bobby was sort of quite approachable, I think. And somebody either liked the way we played or liked what was going on at Ipswich. And they came to him with a proposal saying that they needed some proper footballers to do some footballing scenes in the background for the prisoner of war film. So Bobby called a players' meeting one day at the changing room, explained that this film crew were looking for a few players to make up a squad of background footballers for this prisoner of war film that was going to be set in Hungary. It would mean 5 weeks in Budapest during the summer. You get paid for it. I was single at the time, so people like myself, Johnny Walk, Kevin Beattie, Robin Turner, Laurie Civil, Paul Cooper went out to help teach Stallone how to be a goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. Didn't go down very well.
That was brave of him.
Yeah, it was. But it was only when we got there that we realised that, you know, people like Pelé and Ardiles, Bobby Moore, like three World Cup winners were there. And it wasn't just the case that they were there for the weekend or for a week. We were there 5 weeks with them, you know, in the same hotel, going to the same restaurants, you know, eating together, partying together, playing together, you know, day in, day out for period of 5 weeks. And and of course Pelly would come along and his manager would bring a guitar along as well, and he'd play a few little tunes, a little sing song, have a little drop of scotch, you know, and we'd have another good night out. And people like Bobby Moore, Mike Summerby, Casimir Dana, who's Man City as well, the late Casimir Dana, the late Bobby Moore. And it was just a shame the other week when Pelé died, that Bobby Moore wasn't still around to be able to tell everybody what a great person Pelé was.
Because
as everybody else saying, you know, if it could have come from Bobby Moore, it would have.
If I had to pick one picture outside of Leicester when it comes to football, it's that, you know, Brazil beat us in the 1970 World Cup in the group stage 1-0, and it was the battle of the two titans. And at the end, you could see that mutual respect that they had for each other with that handshake and the chat. And I'll never forget that picture.
No, it's wonderful, isn't it? They both got the shirts off, swapping shirts. So Bobby used to say to me, he said, Russell, did you ever see Bobby Moore play? And I said, yeah, I played against him and played with him. He said,
yeah.
Did you ever see Bobby Moore sweat when he was playing? Mm. I'm thinking, apart from that game in 1970, against, I said, no, usually no. Mm. Just stands at the back and, yeah. And so Bobby said to me, he said, he doesn't sweat because he's always in the right place at the right time. And he intercepts passes rather than making last-ditch tackles. Yeah. And he said to me, he said, that's how you should play. You should think about your game more. Think about your positional sense more. Read situations more.
Mm.
He said, but he said, your problem is you like the physical contact with people. You like to make tackles. You like to make challenges. You like to make last-ditch tackles.
Yeah.
And I remember the following week, with that in mind, we went and played at Manchester City at the Old Main Road. And I think we won 2-0, maybe 3-1 or something like that for Ipswich. And so Bobby was waiting for me as I came off the pitch to go down the tunnel. And he said, Russell, he said, that is the way to play centre-half today.
No.
And Chris, I honestly hadn't broken sweat. I think I touched the ball about four times in the whole game. And I said to him, I said, well, you've got to be joking. I've not done anything. He said, well, you haven't had to. You've always been in the right place at the right time. You've anticipated things rather than make last-ditch tackles. You've dropped off. You've stepped in front. You've played with your brains today.
Mm.
And I looked at him and I thought, the AA's got a point. But it was the most boring game I've ever played in my life.
You were itching to get your foot in, weren't you? You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got to ask, who was the better footballer, Pelé or Michael Caine?
The better footballer. I think Pelé just nicked it.
Did he? Anthony says here as well, is it true that Pelé broke Sylvester Stallone's finger when taking shots past him before filming?
Whether it broke it or not, it definitely did some damage to it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, but Stallone was trying to grab the ball like that. And, you know,
yeah.
He had an arm wrestle with Kevin Beattie one day because Stallone thought he was the big muscle man. And so he did a one-on-one arm wrestle with Kevin Beattie, right hand against right hand. And Kevin Beattie took him down eventually. And much to the annoyance of Sylvester Stallone. So Stallone said, okay, we'll go left-handed now. He didn't realise that Beattie's left-handed.
Bang. He lost 2-0 then, shall we say.
Yeah, we didn't see him much after that.
No. Not that he was anything like a typical American. We shouldn't stereotype him, but, last question.
Fantastic, though.
Yeah, oh, I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, that must have, like I say, you've got your football career, but then to go and do something like that and then meet the players, like you say, like Pelé that were there. Ozzy Ardiles was there as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, great.
Great player. Last question I just want to ask you then, and Anthony, I'm not saying he's going to start stalking you at all, but he's saying, what does Russell do now?
Oh, crikey. I've been doing all sorts of things since I finished coaching. I did 20-odd years work for Eurosport, doing commentary and pundit work, BBC, Sky, until a couple of years ago. Since 2013, I was working in India every year for a company called Star Sports. That was covering the Indian Super League when that first started in 2013, and still going strong now and getting bigger and stronger all the time. So that was good. I still do some after dinner speaking now and guest appearances, and thoroughly enjoy myself as I get into my older age. My wife has a successful interior design business that I keep cracking the whip behind and making sure she keeps doing that.
Yeah, I'm sure she'd say the same if she was on camera about you.
I try and keep busy. I go down and watch Ipswich every home game and keep an eye on them. And yeah, it's good. They've just got to make sure they get promotion this year, that's all.
Yeah, and lucky to go out to Burnley in the cup early in the week. I did say that was the last question. I do apologise. Just one more. Again, it would be remiss of me not to ask this. The Premier League winning season for Leicester. I mean, that came out of nowhere. And you quite rightly said, you know, that Ipswich team under Bobby Robson was everybody's favourite second team at that time. And I think for one season, that was Leicester. And I don't think, if you're outside of North London, sorry, Anthony, I know that you're in the chat, but you came second, okay. Arsenal came second. But outside of North London, I think everybody just wanted us to win it. I mean, how surprised were you, like the rest of us, that we, you know, we pulled it off?
It just proved that by a little bit of application, togetherness, a little bit of understanding and bags of hard work and honesty, you can make it happen.
Yes.
You really can make it happen. But you have to have honesty from your players. They have to be prepared to put a shift in, day in, day out, whether it's on the training ground, whether it's on the match pitch during the important 90 minutes. And for that particular period of time in that season, those boys were really tight as a unit, weren't they? They had a style of play. And even though when it came around to teams playing them for the second time in the season, and they thought, well, we might get found out a little bit now, they still had the application and the desire to make it work for them.
Yes. Yeah.
And it just shows you what can be done.
It can. And I don't often cry as a man, although I'm nothing against it, but two times were when we won that thing, it was presented to us at Everton, and Andrea Bocelli was there singing Ness and Dorma. My God, I was screaming with tears. And when we won the FA Cup, two things I would never see, thought I would see in my lifetime, and two things I saw with my son. And there's something about football that just gets to you sometimes. And obviously I want us to do well, but it was an amazing few seasons that we've just had. But, you know, things move on and money is spent by vast amounts.
Things go around in circles, though, Chris, don't they? Nobody's ever going to stay at the top forever.
No.
Things will always change.
And I think, you know, I think it will happen again, not for Leicester, but I think there will be a season when another club breaks through. And I would say another club. I mean, Newcastle are doing it now and it's good to see, but obviously they've got the money and the backing to do that. I'm not saying that, you know, Leicester aren't a poor club. We've got very rich owners, but in comparison to the so-called Big Six, we're not sort of that sort of time. So I look forward to that happening. Russell, you've been a gentleman, sir. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for the invitation, Chris.
No, thank you. I always appreciate the fact that, you know, people, you know, players give up the time to do this, and really, really do appreciate it. And I wish you all the best to yourself and your good lady. Make sure you know, if she is cracking the whip, that it's only for the business. But, mate, take care, stay safe, and as I say, thank you so very, very much.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Chris. Every success to yourself.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Spurs as well.
Oh, God, yes. Well, the goalkeeper's out, so that's one thing in our favour. But, you know, Harry Kane's going to score. He always does against Leicester.
He can score so long as Leicester score more than what he gets. And
well, I was just saying, he was celebrating scoring, was it 300-odd goals for Spurs recently, but...
Yeah,
you know, Jamie Vardy's got a Premier League medal, a FA Cup medal, and a Community Shield medal. I don't think Harry Kane's got any of those. But anyway, that's me being a little bit.
Get your medals on the table.
Exactly. All the best. And again, thank you very much. Take care.
Take care.
Bye. Thank you so much to Russell for coming on. We always appreciate it. These ex-players give up the time. Obviously, we, you know, they do media work for money. we don't pay them for the money. And Nate has just come in. Sorry, Anthony, I didn't get a chance to. We've gone over the hour, so I didn't get a chance to ask your last question, Ant. Sorry. Nate says, really enjoyed this conversation. Learn a lot about the history of the club and the sport itself. Well done, Chris. Great show. Thank you very, very much. Next Wednesday, we've got another one. No, we haven't. That's a lie. Oh, God. When, I don't know what I'm doing. What date are we on today? The 8th of February. So, yes, that'll teach me for turning too many pages over in my diary. Next Wednesday at the same time, Ian Hume is going to be with us all the way from Canada. He's, of course, Canadian. Had a horrendous head injury, as thankfully, touch wood, and God bless that he's come through that. And he's doing how's the coaching career now in Canada. So, and then the Wednesday after that, we have got, I've got to say, and no disrespect to everybody else that I've had on, but I have got to say that it is probably the biggest ex-player that I've ever had on the show. I can't going to tell you who, because it's going to be a surprise. We're going to build up to it. But Wednesday the 22nd, it is the most... I can't believe that I've got this guy coming on. He's probably grateful that he's finally said yes, because it means I'm not going to stalk him and hassle him anymore. But stay tuned for that. Ian Hume next Wednesday, and then the Wednesday after, it will be, like I say, Mr. Special Guest. Who could it be? It's certainly not this man. There we go. Certainly not him. Sorry. I just laugh every time I see that. I do. But hey, guess what? What is coming up?
Coming up next on Leicester Till I Die TV.
Nine o'clock tomorrow, we have got the Tottenham Hotspur preview. We have got Harry coming on, not Mr. Kane, Harry C from a Tottenham fan channel, who will be coming on to chat with us about the game. And then I am going on their show on, where are we, on 7 o'clock on Friday. I'll be doing the return journey, as they say. And then 9 o'clock Friday night, it's going to be question time, which will be after that moving to a Monday, which we think will be a better night for us. As I said the other day, we are going to play around with the schedules. But the last Friday night question time, 9 o'clock, and we will be talking FFP. After Leicester did all that they did in the summer, you know, we didn't sign players because we did not want to break FFP. And look, I'm not saying that we're perfect. We got done for it when we were in the Championship. We paid a fine off. But we did that, which has made this season extremely hard for us. And then Manchester City come along and go, yeah, so well, we've done it. And you can't find Man City because it's just like, you know, it's money and, you know, it's money, pocket change for them, isn't it? Should they be relegated? We'll be talking about that Friday night at 9 o'clock. But tomorrow, and of course, then we've got the watch along and post-match Spurs shows on Saturday. We will, though. We will be playing, like I say, 9 o'clock tomorrow, the Spurs preview. So join us then. Anthony, thank you so very much, mate. I want to say fair play getting these players on, mate. Appreciate it. I don't know why I do it to myself, because before I do these shows, I'm absolutely so nervous. Oh, my God. I mean, Pontus came out the other week. I mean, I was pooing myself. But I am talking, and I can't believe that my little channel here, which isn't a big channel, it's not the biggest, not the best, but it's fun, hopefully, and I'm getting to talk to these players, heroes of mine, that I have seen on the pitch. You know, I can remember watching Russell play. It's just... I do appreciate them giving up the time. I really, really do. Having said that, for everyone that comes on, three say no. So there we go. Anthony Kamara. We'll have to sort him out. I don't think I can afford him, mate. And I'm glad you enjoy them, Nat. Yeah, we do learn a bit about the club. And it's nice to see the players before and after. And what, and I mean, that Russell Osman in Escape to Victory, one of my favourite films. And I mean the original, not the, the remake when it was about American football or something. The proper one with Pelé and Russell Osman in. And, of course, that other great footballer, Michael Caine. Guys, thank you very much for watching. Anthony and Nate, thank you for all your questions in the chat. Really do appreciate it. Thank you for watching Leicester Till I Die TV. Please sub if you're new. Smash the likes, whether you're new or not. And if you have been listening on your favourite podcast platform, thank you so very, very much. I really appreciate you listening. 42,000 plus downloads last season. We're now part of the TalkSport fan network. That's just going to take us to another level. Anthony, yeah, it's a great film, isn't it? It is a great film. I'm going to go. and I'll be back. I'll be back. I'm going to go, and I will be back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I did have a new outro clip, but I haven't uploaded it, so there we go. Such is life. Such is life. And I will see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Good night. Take care. And remember, whatever you do, don't do anything I wouldn't enjoy. Good night now.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
That's all, folks.
Thanks for watching Leicester Till I Die. This is Chris saying goodbye and see you next time.
Thanks for watching. These videos are tremendous. You better like them too, or I'll be back.
Leicester Till I Die TV. They think it's all over. It is now.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.